between 2010 and 2020, more people participated in protests than in any other decade. But despite those movements, our next guest says many protesters didn't see the lasting change they were after. We're learning what sparked those protests in places like Brazil, Egypt, South Korea, and elsewhere, and why so few were successful, with an author who spent time with demonstrators around the world. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in activism or public protests of some kind? What was the experience like? Do you feel like your demonstration or movement got results? And what do you think makes for a protest movement that actually achieves its goals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Vincent Bevins is an award-winning international journalist and correspondent for publications including The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Financial Times. He's the author of the new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Vincent, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think, Vincent, for a lot of us, hearing the 2010s called the mass protest decade might be a little surprising, especially for us here in America. Our minds might go right to the 1960s and 70s. Can you put it in perspective for us and just remind us how widespread protests were during that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the 1960s is the natural reference point, but everything that we know indicates that around the world from 2010 to 2020, more people did take part in protests than even that very famous cycle of contention back in the 60s. It starts really in Tunisia and then Egypt with what becomes called the Arab Spring, dubbed the Arab Spring by foreign media, and this does start to matter. And then in 2013, you get uprisings in Turkey, Brazil, Ukraine. You move on, you get Hong Kong, you get South Korea, you get Chile, you get Hong Kong again. And I think that what happens in 2020 after the death of George Floyd should be considered part of this broad, broad process of contagion and learning that spreads throughout the world in the 2010s. But it's really when we take a global look at protests that it becomes clear that so much of history in this decade was powered by mass protests and as what I point to as their often unintended consequences.
And this question might not have a good answer because I know every movement has its own goals and its own circumstances, but can we say why we saw so many protests during that 10-year period?
Oh, well, so I think that there must always be multiple causality to get a protest to be very, very big. There must always be more than one thing that is behind people deciding to risk their lives or at least risk their safety to go to the streets. I think that one part of what happens in the 2010s is the long consequences of the 2008 financial crisis. So many, many movements around the world were responding in some way to the fallout of the apparent failures of the global capitalist system that had been promised as such a great thing in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union. I think social media is a part of the story, but again, I think it's only one of the things that gets you over the line to having a mass protest. I don't think it's often what these things are really about. And then, yeah, as you point, you really have to look at national conditions. Sometimes you have an authoritarian government. Sometimes you have horrifying police brutality. Now, police brutality very, very often is the trigger, even if there are many other reasons that people pour into the streets. So one thing that I hope that becomes clear from this book and this investigation is, while certain trends are global, national particularities matter quite a bit. And I think one thing that did happen in what I call the mass protest decade is a tendency to see things as if they were all the same, a tendency to perhaps copy and paste a tactic that seemed to work elsewhere into a very different condition, or a media viewing, major media actors viewing an uprising in one country as if it's the same as another without really understanding the differences between those countries. So I'd say that is an attempt at a complex answer to a good but difficult question.
And you write that a lot of these movements had a similarity in the way they were structured, organized. You say they were often spontaneous and often horizontally structured. What do we mean by that?
So horizontalism was something that was adopted by certain groups as an intentional way of organizing protests. But sometimes you also just saw that things were horizontally structured. And what that means basically is leaderlessness, a situation in which no one can really claim to speak for everybody that is in the square or in the streets. no one that is able to represent the people on the ground, everyone perhaps coming for their own reasons and everyone having their own rights to push for a particular direction. And this was something that came out of certain ideological tendencies in the 90s. The anti-globalization movement was very horizontal, but also it came out of certain countries where, like Egypt, even if the revolutionaries there would have loved to have more structured, hierarchical, and dedicated organizations, there just weren't any left after decades of decimation under authoritarian government. So you saw apparent spontaneity, usually meaning that things come together very, very quickly. And this is not something that happens only because of social media, but social media makes it easier for things to come together more quickly. And when I say horizontal, I mean that there's no one leading it. There's no one to say with authority what this is really about. And there's no one, and this becomes crucial later, to step into a power vacuum if one is created, or to articulate what the streets would accept as a victory.
And we are talking with Vincent Bevins, author of the new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. And Vincent, in most of the examples you look at in your book, you say that they ultimately weren't successful in getting that lasting change. I want to zoom in on one of those right now in one of the largest democracies in the world, a place you worked for a long time, Brazil. Let's go back to 2013 and the Free Fair movement. What was happening there? What were the demands being put forth?
Absolutely. And I think back in the 60s, in other parts of history, it would be quite normal to see protests that get nothing done, that are simply ignored. But we often saw this actually a strange reversal, even if you listen to, especially if you listen to what the original organizers of the protest said that they wanted, they often got the exact opposite. And Brazil is an iconic case of this. And it's one that, as you mentioned, matters dearly to me because I lived through all of it. So the Free Fair movement was a group of leftists and anarchists that were trying to advocate for lower public transportation. Indeed, they wanted public transportation to be free for all Brazilians at all times. And they organized a set of protests starting in June 2013. Now, what happens is that the media call for a crackdown on the protests. The crackdown comes, but the crackdown is so shocking that the country, but especially the mainstream media itself, flip their message and say, actually, this is a great thing. In the morning, they were saying these are punks and anarchists that need to be cleared off the streets after they see this horrible episode of police brutality. The narrative shifts to this is a great thing. This is a uprising in defense, not of this specific transportation cause, but in defense of the right to protest in general. And millions of people flood into the streets. And they all flood to the streets for their own reasons, often understanding what the protests are as a result of how they consumed media representation of the protests. And in the short term, you actually get a conflict between the new arrivals and the original organizers, which ultimately ends in the expulsion of the original leftists and radicals that had organized the protests by new arrivals that tended to be more right-wing. And in the long term, as this huge ball of energy that nobody really knew how to deal with sort of grows and grows, because even though people are starting to talk about Brazil as if it is a Brazilian version of the Arab Spring, a Brazilian Spring, a kind of Tahrir moment, Brazil has a democracy and quite a popular social democratic president. So as this ball of energy grows and no one really knows what to do with it, including the original organizers, including the president, including the mayor of Sao Paulo, who is in charge of lowering the bus fares, a new set of actors sort of emerge from this pressure cooker with a very different set of goals. The Free Fare movement, as you say, the MPL, finds itself replaced ultimately by another group of more free market and libertarian young activists with links to the United States. And they intentionally start a group that is meant to trick people. They start a group which is the Free Brazil movement, but the acronym ends up being MBL. And in this strange cauldron pressure cooker of energy unleashed, many, many groups are born, which ultimately push the country to the right, help to remove elected President Dilma Rousseff, help to elect far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, and really, ultimately, I think, give Brazilians the opposite of what it seemed they were asking for when they first poured into the streets in defense of better public services.
So what was the factor, do you think, that was missing there? And I know you talked to many, many people. You saw it firsthand. What was the missing factor? Was it organization or something else?
Well, in this particular case, and as you point out, I did this book doing something like 225 interviews over 4 years in 12 countries. And so I really asked everybody on all sides of this conflict in Brazil, what could have gone differently? What went wrong? And the answers were often contradictory, but a certain set of conundrums, I would say, arise as really important. On the one hand, this free fair movement believed, like I think a lot of us really always believed, especially in my generation at the beginning of the decade, that if you just got everyone out on the streets behind you, then that would be good. How could that not be good? But it turns out behind is not the same as after. The fact that they come next doesn't necessarily mean that they're behind. They come with their own ideas. And if there's no structure in place to sort of decide what the thing is about, it just becomes a game of counting opinions. And if the new opinions are more right-leaning, then the right-leaning people win control of the streets and they're able to effectively expel the originals. So there's the idea that the street explosion would always go your way turned out not to be true. And then there was the very particularly horizontalist formation of this group in Brazil. They believed they were against leaders. They were against any type of delegation of roles even within the organization. So when it came time to them for them to deal with this unexpected explosion, they had to have 14-hour, 16-hour meetings so that they could get every single person in the group to agree because they believed in the full consensus model of organizing. This is something that we saw in Occupy Wall Street in 2011. This is maybe familiar to some people in the US. And when they said, well, no, we don't want to lead anything, other more savvy people, other people that did not have these sort of idealist approaches to political change, just said, okay, we'll step into the vacuum and we will use our very well-funded and very hierarchically organized organizations to push this whole thing to the right, because there's energy on the streets and we're going to take advantage of it. Now, whether or not it was possible to take advantage of this strange explosion at all, that's hard to say, but it is absolutely true that the right is the one, are the groups that win the battle to redefine what this is all about, and they use their sort of, you know, one of the kids had been trained by the Koch brothers in the United States. Other kids in this far what at the beginning of a far-right movement had been funded by groups in the US. They knew what they wanted to get done, and they were very, very sort of unashamed and merciless about pushing towards the right, and everybody else was left trying to figure out what happened.
We're talking with journalist and author Vincent Bevins about his new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes for an effective protest movement? Have you been part of one yourself? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter in today for Rob Ferret. That's the sound of protesters chanting in the Wisconsin state capitol in 2011 in opposition to the Anti-Union Legislation Act 10, one of the many protests of the last decade. We're taking a global look at protests in the 2010s right now with Vincent Bevins. His new book is If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones now. We have Jody with us in Downing. Hi, Jody.
I actually got on the show a little late, so I don't know if you've already covered this, but I'm looking for some hope here and hoping that the author has some ideas of what has worked or what does work. Because being in Wisconsin and watching what happened at the Capitol that you just played is really disheartening. So I'll hang up and listen.
Jody, thanks for the call. We haven't covered that yet, but I wanted to. Vincent, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't get cover this. I'm grateful to Jody for pushing me in this direction. These 250, 225 interviews that I did, these people that I spoke with around the world, they would not have sat down with me. They would not have gone through these very difficult experiences. They would have not been part of this project to create a book out of this decade if they did not believe in learning from what had happened and coming back to fight better another day. There is, I think, a clear desire across the planet to change our particular global system. And so if, as I think emerges out of this book, the problem is really one of tactics, of a mismatch between tactics and goals, then what is an apparently pessimistic story becomes quite an optimistic one. Because if it's really just a mismatch between tactics and goals, well, that's not so hard to do. You've got the energy, you've got the people, you've got the people willing to take risks and take action. You just need to change the recipe slightly. And the answers to how to change the recipe vary, as you would expect, over a couple hundred interviews. But some things rise to the top as being, shared by many of the interviewees. And one is that the better organized you are going into the unexpected explosion, the better you're going to do inside of it. It's very difficult to put together a real movement, a real organization, which is capable of acting collectively in the heat of the moment. So one lesson that often emerges from these conversations is to build in the off season, build bonds with other human beings when it seems like nothing is happening, because they can be useful in ways which you could not imagine. And then again, in this book, not everything is a failure, right? So there are cases where things do move forward in slightly unexpected ways. But in Chile, you get a president from the protest generation of 2011. And this is the same, I think. I think that the Wisconsin protests, although I don't know the content so well myself, I think that they really do fit into this sort of post-Tahrir Square Egyptian inspired group of protests. If I'm not mistaken, someone in Egypt like sent pizza to Wisconsin. This transfer of solidarity across countries is really great. The version of this that takes place in Chile eventually wins power, and it takes years. What is an apparent failure becomes an ultimate victory, because they don't give up, they reorganize, they enter institutional power, some of them stay on the streets. So I do hope that the book, it's hard to summarize everything now, but I do hope that it looks forward as well as backwards.
And it sounds like one of the takeaways, well, you ask people, what is your advice for future generations of activists, whatever their causes may be? And it sounds like people were content with the fact that that they were happy with the fact that they have shown there's energy that's possible, like pre-visioned a better future and a better system. Is that fair to say?
I think that what a lot of people told me is that they hope to live in a future in 10 years in which, looking back on what I call the mass protest decade, they see the seeds of an ultimate victory. They see that the first kicks and starts demonstrated a real desire for improvements to the global system. It didn't work perfectly the first time around, but that you can come back, take that energy, learn from it, and rebuild with a better understanding of the stakes and the way things go after the initial apparent success. Because one of the things that happens over and over in this book, and because it happens in the decade, is that mass protests, not accidentally, but unexpectedly, put far, far more people on the streets than they had imagined were possible. The original organizers are overwhelmed by just how many people can come together for the broad goal of changing the world for the better. And then that generated opportunities. And we just talked briefly about the Brazilian context, but across the decade, that generated opportunities that people hadn't really thought about. But now we can see how this goes. We can see what kinds of things that may be worth preparing for, thinking about, if you are organizing mass movements. And so a lot of people came back and said, yeah, now we know what happens. And we hope that when it happens again, enough people that believe that, that think like me, that are ideally working with me hand in hand, will have learned from the first round and can come back better.
And what do you think will happen in this decade in terms of protests, in terms of movements aligning those tactics with their goals? Do you think we'll see a change?
I don't know. I think that whatever is going to happen, and this is it sounds like I'm evading the question, but I also do believe in this answer. Whatever is going to happen, whatever is going to come our way, whether or not it's a new war in the Middle East, whether or not it's climate catastrophe, whether or not it's the breakdown of the governance of the United States, Washington, D.C., the more we carefully study recent history, the more we carefully study what's the actual conditions of things around us, the better equipped we're going to be to respond to what comes.
And as we wrap up, Vincent, what are you hoping people take away from your book? If they're, especially from an American context, and they may not be as familiar with these international movements, what do you think they really take away? What do you hope resonates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that each reader will come to this book with a different set of experiences. And I think Wisconsin readers will view it in terms of what they've lived through. I've been gratified. I just did a tour of the U.S. A lot of people told me that the book reflected their experiences. I think that people, you know, in Iran will view the book reflected through their experiences. But if I had to come up with, you know, a quick summary of an optimistic and forward-looking lesson that I found touching in the book, because I'm trying to avoid giving any of my own, but one of the lessons that I found touching that came out of the interviews at the end is like, look, an imperfect world is here. We're going to be alive. There's no better way to spend this life than finding other people that want to improve the world, improve life for other human beings, and working hand in hand with them to build a better future. It may not work right away. It may not work for a long time. But if you know that you're doing your best to create the best world that you can, and you're doing it hand in hand with other people, there's no better way to spend your life.
Well, Vincent, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Vincent Bevins, author of the new book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution.